From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Veiled Ghost of Highgate. There was standing when I was young in the vicinity of Highgate, North London, a quaint, rambling, red brick house with a moss-grown courtyard in front. Inside were large, gloomy rooms and dark staircases and passages. The owner of the house resided abroad. No one lived in it for long, and the following traditional story was associated with it. Towards the end of the 18th century, there was living in the house a Mr. Bruce, his wife and daughters. Charles, the only son of Mr. Bruce, and a wild and reckless youth, had been living in Paris for 2 years, when he suddenly returned home, so ill that he had to be put to bed, and Miss Black, a nurse, engaged to attend him. On her arrival, Miss Black was shown into the invalid's room. The furniture was of the handsome, heavy kind, characteristic of those times. The panelling on the walls was black with age, the fireplace supported by massive buttresses. The large curtained bed in which Charles lay stood in the center of the room, and an oil lamp glimmered on a table. Miss Black replenished the fire, which was low, and sitting down at the table started to read the Bible. She had been instructed to keep very quiet. Now and again blasts of wind shook the leafless branches of the great trees in the garden, while snow spluttered on the embers as it was wafted down the wide chimney. Curious to see her patient, Miss Black gently pulled aside the curtain round his bed. Contrary to her expectation, he was not asleep, but lay motionless on his back, his bright blue eyes glaring fixed on her face, his underlip fallen, mouth apart, cheeks a perfect hollow, his long white teeth projecting fearfully from the shrunken lips, while a bony hand, covered with wiry sinews, was stretched on the bedclothes. He was not a pleasant sight. Miss Black quickly returned to the table, leaving the curtain still drawn aside. About midnight, the patient began to breathe heavily and seemed to be very restless. Turning to look at him, Miss Black was greatly surprised to see a closely veiled woman seated in a chair near the head of the bed. Miss Black was about to move when the woman motioned to her to keep her seat. Miss Black could not see the woman's face owing to the veil, but she got the impression that she was young and good-looking. She was slender and rather tall, and wore a light green dress. She had gold earrings, a large gold locket and chain, and a massive, bejeweled bracelet of curious workmanship, all of which sparkled in the lamplight. Miss Black concluded that the woman was a relative. Charles Bruce, who had become more than ever restless, heaved and sighed and seemed in great distress. Miss Black was rising to go to him when the woman again motioned for her to remain seated. The heat from the fire made Miss Black drowsy, and she dozed for a few minutes. When she awoke, the woman had gone. At the same hour the next night, the same thing happened. Miss Black was reading at the table when, on looking at the bed, she saw the veiled woman seated beside the patient. She got up and, undeterred by the repellent action of the woman, approached the bed, whereupon the woman rose and moved slowly and noiselessly toward the door. The face of her patient terrified Miss Black. Deep drops of sweat were on his brow, and his lips quivered as if in agony. His glaring eyes followed the receding figure of the woman, who mysteriously vanished just before she reached the door. The strain she had undergone watching the sick man and the strange woman was so great that Miss Black told the Bruces she could not stay another night in the house. It was only after the doctor implored her to remain that she very reluctantly yielded. The next night was Christmas Eve. It was bitterly cold but dry. The wind moaned and sighed and rattled the ill-secured shutters, generating dismal echoes in the gloomy passages of the old building. At the same hour as on the previous nights, the veiled woman suddenly appeared by the bed of the invalid. His gasping and heaving made Miss Black's heart sicken, and when, in spite of the warning hand of the strange woman, she approached the bed, the corpse-like features of Charles became horribly convulsed, his eyes starting from their sockets. Miss Black spoke, but there was no reply. She touched him very gently. He was cold with terror, and unconscious of any object but the mysterious woman. Thinking her patient was going to expire, Miss Black was about to go for assistance when the woman bent over Charles, who made a feeble effort to keep her away. Miss Black ran at once to the woman, whose clothes were very wet, although the weather was dry, and obeying a sudden impulse, raised her veil. There was no face under it, only a blank. The shock Miss Black received was so great that she fainted. She was found in the morning lying on the floor, only half conscious. Charles Bruce lay stiff and lifeless, one hand across his eyes, as if to shade them from some object he feared to look on. The other hand gripped the coverlet. The same morning it was later discovered the body of a foreign woman, young and beautiful, in a green dress with gold earrings, a gold locket and chain, and a massive bejeweled gold bracelet of curious workmanship, was washed ashore on the Kent coast. She had been in the water 3 or 4 days. Her identity, if known to certain people in England, was never divulged. The Bruces left the house soon after the death of Charles and never returned. It was shortly after their departure that the house was rumored to be haunted by the ghost of a young man, supposedly Charles Bruce, who was seen and heard wandering disconsolately in the dead of night from room to room, along passages and up and down staircases, ever seeking companionship and sympathy, and finding none. The Grey Horror. In the summer of 1894, when on my way out west in the USA, I stayed for a week at a hotel in Denver. There I met William Smith, an elderly minister who was well versed in the traditional ghost stories and legends of some of the American states. One evening when we were alone, he told me about the dreadful gray ghost that had formerly haunted Greenberg Valley on the eastern shore of the River Hudson. This is his story. One afternoon in the 70s of the last century, two young men, Herbert Hall and Walter Wren, arrived at a little village near the eastern shore of the Hudson, the inhabitants of which were mostly of Dutch extraction. After they had a meal at the village inn, they asked the landlord to tell them the way to Greenberg, a small port on the Hudson where they intended to stay the night. "There are two ways," the landlord said, "the one a good deal longer than the other, but preferable when it is getting dusk." "What difference does that make?" Wren asked. "Is the road very rough?" "It is very rutty and rocky in places," the landlord said, "but that is not what I had in mind." "What did you have in mind?" Hall queried, eyeing him keenly. The landlord hesitated. "There's a valley a mile from Greenberg which has a bad reputation." "Robbers?" The landlord shook his head. "What then?" Wren asked impatiently. "Well," the landlord said, "the folk around here say it is haunted." The young man burst out laughing. "You don't mean to say you believe in ghosts?" Hall said. "I have long wanted to see a ghost. What is the story associated with the valley? I'll be bound there is one. A murder?" The landlord shrugged. "There are all sorts of stories, but you would only ridicule them." He proceeded to give them directions as to both ways of getting to Greenberg. Thanking him and declaring their intention of bearding the lion, or rather ghost, in its den, they selected the road through the valley, and with their knapsacks once again strapped to their backs, they set off at a brisk pace. At last our travelers reached the summit of a hill, and deep down beneath them they saw spread out for some considerable distance a thickly wooded valley, all dark and mysterious in the uncertain twilight. As they descended into it, they became aware of the funeral-like silence that greeted them on all sides. The dale was, in fact, so deeply situated that even the wind, which for the last half hour or so had been blowing with great force along the surface of the hill, was scarcely to be felt there. Occasionally, a fitful blast could be heard among the lofty trees when the pale fall leaves gave out a curious husky crackling. Otherwise, all was absolutely wonderfully still. The two men were so impressed that neither spoke until they had arrived at the bottom of the decline. and were standing in almost Stygian darkness amidst the shadows of the foliage on either side of them. Hall was the first to break the silence. "This must be the haunted glen," he said. "Pretty cheerful, isn't it?"
"It is that," Ren said, looking around him, trying to pierce the gloom. "But come on, I vote we get out of it as soon as possible."
Further on, they came to a wide open spot where there were crossroads. Here the shadows lay very thick, so thick indeed that they had to curb their pace and proceed very slowly, lest they should take the wrong route. It was while they were thus engaged, straining their eyes and peeping around them apprehensively, that they became impressed with the certainty of some object moving slowly ahead of them through the gloom. At such an hour, for it was now getting late, and in such a dreary place, this was calculated to challenge attention, and Wren and Hall found themselves gazing at the object with an intensity that had in it something not very far removed from fear. By and by they were able to see it a little more clearly, and they perceived it was a very tall figure, apparently a man walking at an even pace, but with immensely long strides. He was going in the same direction as they were, and was only a few feet in front of them, but to their astonishment they found that although they accelerated their pace with the idea of overtaking him, they did not approach the least degree nearer. Without seeming to increase his speed, he yet maintained invariably the same distance away from them. They had now struck off along a road they believed to be the right one and were walking tolerably fast. The figure preceding them, however, was seemingly in no way aware of their proximity, for without once turning its head towards them, with the same measured stride it steadily advanced. At length Hall, more perhaps to relieve his feelings than anything else, called out, "Hello there! Who are you?" There was no response. The figure did not show by any gesture the slightest consciousness that it had heard, but continued pacing on at the same rate and at the same distance. The two friends now suddenly realized that their sense of hearing, which the strangely emphasized silence of the place had rendered abnormally acute, had not caught any sound of footsteps coming from the figure. They could readily decipher the echoes of their own, but the figure seemed trod with absolute noiselessness. This came as an unpleasant surprise, and soon they became poignantly aware of the advent of novel and distinctly uncomfortable feelings. Pride prevented them admitting this, and they were striving to rally their faculties in at all events to simulate unconcern when the unexpected happened. The figure promptly swerved off the road and, making for a large wooden gate leading onto a gravel drive, came directly into the moonlight. Both Wren and Hall at once emitted an involuntary cry. Instead of being clothed, the figure was nude. It gleamed a horrible, sinister gray. It had very long arms and legs, and a peculiarly small and rotund head, and when it suddenly turned and looked at the two travelers, it revealed a strange and startling countenance. The features were more or less human, but the expression in the big, deep, sunken, light green eyes was not. So frightful was it, so indescribable, exultant, and devilish, that Wren and Hall shrank back, appalled, too petrified with fear to utter a sound. Fortunately, however, the figure showed no inclination to dally. Moving onward, still with the same peculiar, lengthy, and measured stride, it advanced up the drive, eventually disappearing from view round a rather abrupt curve. A few seconds later, there was a faint sound in the direction it had taken, resembling a human cry, and a moment or so later, still from the other direction, there was a repetition of the noise, but much more prolonged and bearing with it a tone of suffering quite beyond the ability of words to describe. There was another pause, and then apparently nearer, a yell of the most piercing intensity, the animal element in it seeming to strive for mastery with the human, and its final echoes had scarcely died away before the whole valley became alive with appalling sounds, with moanings plaintive and yet horribly menacing, and with whoopings interspersed with harsh, discordant cries and queer, hollow-sounding, long, reverberating laughter. This went on for about a minute, and then quite suddenly ceased and was followed by a silence unbroken, save for the gentle rustling of the fast-dying foliage and the melancholy sighing and soughing of the night breeze. Wren and Hall waited for a few minutes until they could sufficiently pull themselves together, and then continued their tramp.
eventually reaching their destination without further mishap. William Smith stopped here and said that was enough for one night. The following night, he went on with his story. An Irishman named Patrick O'Rourke, hearing about the ghostly experience of Hall and Wren, went to the village inn where the two men had stopped on their way to Greenburg and prevailed upon the landlord to tell him anything he knew about the Grey Ghost and Haunted Valley, and this was what the landlord said. 4 years ago, last April, I was going through the valley in the early hours of the morning. The dawn had only just broken, and the track in places was still dark. Well, when I was pretty nearly opposite the large wooden gate leading into the White Grange, as we call it, my horse, I was riding a brown cob that I had not had in my possession very long, suddenly shied, and I saw sitting by the wayside up against the trunk of an elm, a tall figure. In the uncertain light, I thought it was a man, some tramp, was either having a nap or was ill. I called out to him, and as he did not reply, I called again, and was considering dismounting to see what was the matter with him, when he suddenly and with amazing agility sprang to his feet. I then got a fearful shock. It was no man at all, but a grim and ghastly caricature of one. It was gigantic, 10 or 12 feet high in height. It seemed it was nude, its skin being seemingly a glistening uniform gray, and its face like that of a death's head. A death's head, however, with something frightfully lurid and evil in its big round eye sockets. I had not time to observe more because my horse bolted, but when I eventually reined it in and looked around, I saw the thing, whatever it was, cross the road with enormous bounds and disappear through the gateway leading to the White Grange. Here the old man paused for a moment, then clearing his throat, he went on again. There were two travelers that the Grey Ghost actually touched, or at least one of them. They were walking through the woods when they heard footsteps behind them. They turned and saw following them a great grey shape whose unearthly long arms trailed along the ground. It was of unearthly height, too. Its head seemed to tower up into the trees, and that head was a grinning skull. The men began to run, but the thing covered at one stride 10 times the ground they could. Closer and closer it came, the gigantic gray shape that pursued the fleeting travelers. And suddenly a soft, incredibly repugnant, something like a cloudy hand, half-turned to flesh, covered like a mask the face of one of them. He shrieked once and fell. The other, crying with horror, ran on. The thing did not pursue him. Next morning, a search party went from the village to seek the other traveler. They found him wandering in the woods, half insane. He never quite recovered his mind. Here the old man paused again. "And there is no accounting for the haunting?" O'Rourke asked. "There are theories," the old man said. O'Rourke then inquired of him the name of the present owner of the White Grange, and having obtained it, he went on his way. A week later, and he was back again in the same neighborhood. In the interval, he had written to the owner of the property, and somewhat to the owner's astonishment, had obtained leave to stay a night there. The night chosen for the expedition proved to be exceptionally wild and stormy. O'Rourke had invited 3 friends of his living in the county to go with him to the Grange. He had chosen them because they were very stolid, matter-of-fact athletes, not in the least likely to give way to nerves. Having first assured themselves no one was hiding anywhere in the house, they looked for a spot to commence their vigil and finally selected the room O'Rourke believed, from the description given to him, was the haunted chamber. It was situated at one end of the corridor and possessed 2 doors, the one leading into the corridor and the other into what in earlier days was styled a powder closet. It was an oddly constructed apartment, for across the middle of it were 2 pillars, and on the walls between them hung a grotesque-looking piece of tapestry. The 4 friends sat on the floor in a row right across the room, O'Rourke facing the corridor, Moore and Ross facing the tapestry, and Ventry facing the entrance to the powder closet. At first, every now and then, they fancied they heard soft footsteps tiptoeing up and down the corridor. Once they seemed actually to be in the room, but after a time these sounds all died away and there was nothing but silence, unbroken save for the occasional rattling of doors and windows and the beating of rain against the panes of glass. One by one, the quarter fell asleep to be awakened by hearing the church clock sonorously boom out three. Moore at once rose to his feet. "Look here," he said, "it's morning. Nothing will happen now, and I have to be at..." Then he suddenly changed his tone, and with a wild cry of, "Oh God! Oh my God! There it is!" he staggered back against the wall. The other three looked, and in the dim light of dawn, that struggled to get in through the crevices of the shutters, they saw standing erect between the pillars a luminous something. Nothing more at first. By and by, however, while all were gazing at it in open-mouthed wonder and excitement, it suddenly became hideously and alarmingly vivid, and they saw an immense form, streaked, so it seemed to them, a lurid black and gray. Moore and Ross glanced at its face, and they said afterwards it was like the face of a corpse, only a corpse that was nearly in the skeleton stage, the skin being tightly drawn over the bones and the mouth devoid of flesh and grinning. The impression it gave them was that it was intensely hostile. O'Rourke and Ventry contented themselves with peering at the body only. They did not dare raise their eyes to the head. They stared at it for some moments until, in fact, it began to approach them, when Moore gave way to panic and shrieked out, "Strike a light, one of you!" O'Rourke then lit a candle, and the thing at once vanished. The four men did not stay to talk the matter over. They made for the corridor immediately and hurriedly left the house. A week or so later came a kind of sequel. O'Rourke was again in the neighborhood. Indeed, the spot so fascinated him that he paid a flying visit to it. When he was in the valley looking around him, a stranger suddenly came in sight and accosted him. He said that on the very night O'Rourke had his friends in the big house looking for the ghost, he had seen it. "It crossed from there," he said, pointing to a tall isolated tree on one side of the road, close to a pit with a wide, dark, gaping mouth. "Watch that pit closely tomorrow night between 12 and 3 o'clock. It is the pit that causes the White Grange in the valley to be haunted. It goes right down into the bowels of the earth. There are holes like it in Peru and Brazil. They attract and harbor a foul and dangerous species of elemental spirits." Precisely at the time mentioned, O'Rourke went to the haunted valley. The night was fine, but dark scurrying clouds suggested the possibility of rain. The pit made his flesh creep. There was something so eerie and menacing about it. He approached it cautiously and was gazing at it apprehensively when he got a terrific start. Rising out of its reputed fathomless depth was a luminous, ghastly gray head. The only live thing about it was a lurid, baleful light in the depths of its fleshless eye sockets. It was the same horrible phantom that O'Rourke and his friend had seen in the White Grange. O'Rourke stared at it aghast, and when grisly shoulders gradually appeared, he did not wait to see any more, but took to his heels. He was quite satisfied that what the stranger had told him about the pit was true. He never went to the valley again. Some years later, the supposed fathomless pit was filled in, and when that was done, Granberg Valley ceased to be haunted. Thus ended the strange story that William Smith so kindly told me in Denver City more than 70 years ago. The Haunting of the Gory Hotel. I was having a discussion one day in my London club with Sir Roland Melville, Bart, about ghostly phenomena, and he told me the following experience which he had some years previously. He was traveling one day from Paddington to Penzance in an express. On the way, the train was held up when the line was blocked through the collapse of a bridge, and he was obliged to seek a room for the night in Plymouth. After much hunting, he at last found one in a hotel not far from the Hoe. The room was a back one on the first floor. It smelled fusty. The bed was in the middle of the floor, and on one side of it was a large cupboard. There was a gas fire in the room, and Sir Roland sat by to warm himself, for it was a very cold night. Tired with his journey and made drowsy by the heat of the fire, he went to bed and dozed fitfully, being awakened by a laugh, loud and mocking. He sat up indignantly and saw an eerie spherical light on the door of the cupboard. As he stared wonderingly at the door, it began to open very slowly. Little by little the aperture increased and an object appeared. It was a luminous head, the head of a man. The mouth was bared in a ferocious grin, and the dark glittering eyes suffused with diabolical hatred. The aperture kept widening until a whole body appeared. In one hand, it held a carving knife. Stealing stealthily out of the cupboard, the man, crouching down, crept towards the bed. Petrified, Sir Roland watched him as he drew nearer and nearer. After what seemed to him years, the man reached the bed and, bending over it, raised his knife. As it was about to descend, the spell which had chained Sir Roland ended, and tumbling out of bed, he made for the door. He stayed on the landing till he could not stand the cold any longer. Ashamed of his fear, he then went back into the room. It was in darkness. There was no sign of the phantom. He slept till morning. The line not being quite cleared, Sir Roland had to spend another night in the hotel. As on the previous night, he sat for a time by the fire in his room and then got into bed. He fell asleep and woke with a start to feel a cold, clammy, bare body lying by his side. He sat up and made to spring out of bed, but found he could not. He was again limp and tongue-tied, and again an eerie light appeared on the cupboard. As before, the phantom man emerged from the cupboard and crept to the bed. His eyes, glowing with malicious joy, were fixed not on Sir Roland, but on the man by his side, as he raised his gleaming knife. The chain which had held Sir Roland spellbound broke as before, and springing out of bed, he got to the landing. This time he did not return to his bedroom, but sat in the coffee room till morning. He angrily related his experiences to the landlord of the hotel, who was full of apologies for putting him in the room, which he admitted was haunted. According to the tale he told Sir Roland, about 100 years previously the hotel had been a private house owned by Mr. Jasper Stevens, a widower, who had made a fortune in the West Indies. His only companion in the house was his servant, Tom, whom he had brought from Jamaica. Tempted by the money Mr. Stevens foolishly kept in the house, Tom murdered him and disappeared. The police failed to trace him. Sir Roland suggested that the cupboard out of which the servant's ghost emerged should be examined. This was done. At the back of it was a spring, which, being opened, revealed the secret chamber. Crouching on the floor of the chamber, a blood-stained knife by his side, and a heap of gold coins in front of him, was the skeleton. Apparently the servant, discovering the spring, had got into the cupboard, but been unable to get out of it, so starving to death. Hence the haunting by his ghost. Efforts to exorcise it proved futile, and the haunting continued until the hotel was demolished, a year after Sir Roland Melville stayed in it. The London Villa of Ghostly Dread. In a by-road not far from the old Crystal Palace, there was standing prior to 1914 a small villa known locally as the Mystery House. It was often to be let, as no one ever stayed there for long. After it had stood empty for a considerable time, a family named Trent took it. Mrs. Trent thought there was something strange about the house almost the moment that she crossed the threshold. However, nothing unpleasant happened till they had been in it a fortnight. On entering her bedroom in haste one morning, Mrs. Trent drew up sharply on seeing the bedstake shake and one of the pillows move. Wondering if some pet animal was in the bed, she went to it and very cautiously raised the pillow. There was nothing under it. She removed the bedclothes, but there was nothing under them. She peered under the bed. There was nothing there. Mystified, but thinking it was probably just her imagination or maybe some kind of an illusion or hallucination, she thought no more of it. The following night, Mr. Trent was awakened by a spine-chilling scream coming from his wife's room, which was next to his. In a terrible fright, he jumped out of bed and dashed to her. In the moonlight, which flooded the room, he saw his wife trying to push away a pillow which was over her face. Something seemed to be pressing it down. He seized the pillow and found himself struggling with an invisible thing that smelt horribly. The struggle seemed to him to last interminably, but more likely was only a few seconds. To his relief, whatever it was desisted, and the pillow fell to the floor. His wife had been too exhausted to help him, and it was not until she had fully recovered that she was able to talk. She said that all she knew was when she awoke from a nasty dream. The pillow had been removed from under her head and was over her face, and she felt someone was trying to smother her. Mr. Trent persuaded her to change rooms with him. She did, and nothing further took place for a week. Mr. Trent was then alone in the house. His wife, children, and the maid having gone for the afternoon to Hampstead. Fancying he heard a noise in the basement, he went down to inspect the place but found nothing to account for it. Having satisfied himself that the doors and windows were all securely fastened, he was mounting the kitchen staircase when he heard footsteps following him. He looked round, but there was no one there. Thinking it must have been his imagination, he went on again, but he had not mounted more than a couple more steps when he again heard the footfalls behind him. He abruptly swung round, and for a moment the sight of his own shadow, which stood out very black on the cream-colored wall beneath him, made his heart beat with unusual fierceness, but there was still no one to be seen. He stamped his feet and mounted a couple more steps, but everything was quite still, and he had gained the hall and was halfway up the flight of stairs leading to the first landing when the same mysterious footfalls were again audible. In spite of his skepticism for ghosts and the like, he now felt a ghastly fear stealing fast upon him, and with these uncomfortable sensations he continued his ascent. There was no repetition of the steps now until he had arrived on the top landing, when they came running up behind him very fast, as if someone was making frantic efforts to overtake him. This time it was with an effort he turned round, but as on the former occasion there was no one to be seen. The unaccountable nature of the occurrence filled him with vague and almost horrible sensations, and yielding to the excitement he felt gaining control over him, he leaned over the banisters and shouted sternly, "Who is there?" The sound of his own voice thus exerted in the utter solitude of the house, and followed by the most death-like silence, had in it something so unpleasantly thrilling that he now experienced a degree of nervousness which he had never felt before. A week later, and the place was once more to let. Then an ex-actress of the name of Catling took it. She arrived with a whole retinue of dogs, Poms and Dachshunds. The first weekend of her tenancy passed uneventful enough. The dogs were very restless at night, growling and whining and keeping very close to one another, but she attributed that to their being in new surroundings, and never for one moment gave it serious heed. Then one evening, one of the Poms suddenly cried out as if it had been hurt. She ran upstairs to her bedroom, where she had left it, and found it lying on the floor. At first she thought it was asleep, but on examining it more closely she discovered it was dead. She was puzzling this over when something attracted her attention to the bed, and to her surprise she saw one of the pillows was standing on end. She approached it, and then came to a sudden halt. The pillow had assumed the most extraordinary and wholly unaccountable shape. It was like a face, the face of some very bizarre animal, with a monstrously long nose and two deep-set eyes that gleamed horribly and with apparent devilish merriment. It so fascinated her that for some minutes she simply stood staring at it, and then yielding to a sudden paroxysm of fury she rushed at it, and catching hold of it, straightened it out and flung it on the ground. "You killed the dog," she shrieked, "and want to harm me. You won't! You won't!" There now followed a fairly long spell of comparative quiet. Then one night the unexpected happened. Mrs. Catling, as per habit, went for a walk accompanied by her pets, and did not return home till late. The house was in pitch darkness, and she was in the hall, groping about for matches for the gas, when a box was quietly slipped into her outstretched hand. As might be expected, she was terribly taken aback, and for some seconds she stood stock still, not knowing what to think or do. If it was a burglar, she tried to argue, why had he not struck her? And yet, if it was not a burglar, who could it possibly be? The suspense at length became so unbearable that, resolving to learn the worst and see whatever it was face to face, she struck a light and then very cautiously peered around. There was no one, nothing to be seen. Mystified, she now went upstairs to bed, and having locked and barricaded the door after, she speedily undressed and crept in between the sheets. She slept till morning, and was in the fact of dressing and laughing at her fears during the night, when close to her elbow she heard a long protracted sigh. She immediately turned round, but there was no one there, nothing to account for it. A week or so after this, she had some friends round to spend the evening with her. They played cards and were in the middle of an exciting hand of bridge, when one of them, who was merely a spectator, uttered a loud exclamation and pointed to the wall. "Look at that picture," she said. "What is making it behave like that?" They all glanced in the direction she indicated and were greatly astonished at seeing an old colored engraving in a frame swaying violently to and fro without any apparent cause. They all sat quite still and strained their ears, but there was absolute silence, not the remotest sound of any kind, either from within or without. One of them then went to the window, which, though open at the top, was closed at the bottom, and peered out. "The night seems very calm and still," she said. "It would take a good deal of wind to make that picture move." Then suddenly it was still and absolutely motionless. Like all the other pictures in the room, and everyone present felt a curious sensation of relief. Nothing of further moment occurred during the rest of Mrs. Cantley's short tenancy, and after she had left the premises, they stood empty for another long period. It was during this interlude that an adventure in connection with a house is said to have befallen two people living in the neighborhood. They were a young man and girl, sweethearts, who, strolling out together one evening, chanced to pass the mystery house. "Strange that house never lets, isn't it?" the young man remarked as they paused in front of it and gazed up at the windows. "I wonder what's wrong with it." "Why, they do say as how it's haunted," the girl replied. "But ghosts is all nonsense, ain't they, Reg?"
"I reckon so," Reg laughed, then fired with a sudden inspiration.
"I say, supposing we sit for a while in the back garden, it will be nice and quiet there."
From the garden, the couple commanded a complete view of the back of the house, and they were commenting on the appearance of it, how peculiarly neglected and deserted it looked, when they simultaneously gave vent to a deep, "Oh!" Exactly opposite them on the first floor was a window, and up to the present it had been bathed in gloom. Now, however, quite suddenly it became illuminated with a dull, glimmering light of an unhealthy bluish color which appeared to originate from within the house. They fled precipitately and on future occasions took every care to give the mystery house a distinctly wide berth. The next recorded happening at the house occurred quite late in its life. A Mrs. Everly took it for 6 months, and her household consisted of herself, grown-up daughter Barbara, and two servants, Matilda and Phyllis. The disturbance began the very first night of their tenancy. Going to bed somewhat early, as she was very tired, Barbara awoke with a violent start to see in the white moonlight a very tall form in black bending over her, and the next moment the bedclothes were snatched violently off her. The bed was then shaken vigorously to and fro. This went on for some seconds when at last, to her infinite relief, the figure left the bedside and she heard the door give a loud slam. Barbara's terror was so great that for some minutes she dared not stir. As soon, however, as her faculties had somewhat recovered from the shock, she sprang out of bed and rushed into her mother's room. Mrs. Everly was a very strong-minded woman, not in the least degree afraid of burglars, and rousing the servants, she bade them search the house with her. They did so, going into every room and examining the cellar and cupboards, but they found no one and could discover nothing which would explain in any way the remarkable occurrence. About a week later, the whole household was roused in the middle of the night by the sound of hammering, coming apparently from the basement of the house. As the servants refused point-blank to accompany Mrs. Everly downstairs to see what it was, she lit her candle and went alone. When she arrived in the basement, she found the kitchen door wide open, while on the table in the center of the floor, she saw what appeared to be an enormous black coffin. The shock at encountering such a ghastly spectacle was so terrific that she at once fainted. Hearing her fall, Barbara and the maids hastened to her assistance, and, on reaching the basement, all three saw the shadowy outlines of something they could only describe as infinitely alarming and grotesque come out of the kitchen, run past them, and ascend the staircase with gigantic bounds. This came as a climax, and within a week the house once again stood empty. The house had been standing empty for some long time when the landlord, happening to visit it one day, fancied he could detect a smell of gas. He sent for a plumber, and prior to the man's arrival waited in one of the rooms. After a while, hearing, as he thought, a noise on the top landing, he ran upstairs to ascertain the cause of it, and not discovering anything to account for it, came down again, and was surprised to find the plumber had arrived and was already engaged at his job. "How on earth did you get in?" he asked the man. "I made sure I'd shut all the doors."
The man made no reply, however, and the landlord, concluding he must be deaf, watched him in silence for some minutes, and then hearing a knock at the front door, went to see who was there. Rather to his astonishment, it was another plumber. "Why, how is this?" he said. "One of your men is already here. Surely there is no need for two." "It can't be one of our men, sir," the plumber responded, "for I am the only man available. He must have come from somewhere else." "You are from Smith's, are you not?" the landlord asked. "Yes, sir," was the reply. "Well, the other man must have come from them too," the landlord answered, "for that is the only firm I sent to. You had better come inside and see." Bidding the man follow him, he went to the room where he had left the workman, but there was no sign of him. Remarking that it was very odd, he called out, but there was no response. He then searched the premises, but there were no traces of the workman anywhere, and with Smith's man examined the gas pipes, he quickly found the leakage. There were no evidence whatever of any attempt having been made at a repair. The landlord, of course, knew the reputation the mystery house had acquired, and he could only conclude that what he had witnessed was another of its already long list of ghosts. The original owner of the house, who had committed suicide, had been a man of very bad reputation, and it was thought that the hauntings might either be due to his earthbound evil spirit or to something that occurred on the side of the house before it was built.